In the Marvel film world, Thor has been waving his hammer around again. But as much as this Norse mythology can be remade by New Zealand's best filmmaker, sometimes it's good to be reminded of the foundational stories, which is why writer Neil Gaiman decided to revisit those stories himself. Neil Gaiman, how long have you walked with the gods and giants from Norse mythology?
I suppose I started walking with them, although slightly unknowingly, when I was about 6 years old. So that would be about 50 years ago. And I was in Sussex in England, and my dad used to bring me every Friday comics, and there was a comic called Fantastic, which reprinted the American Marvel comics, and it reprinted The Adventures of Thor, the Mighty Thor. And I got interested. I didn't know who he was. I didn't know about the myths at that point, but this seemed like something I should know about.
Well, I didn't read the Thor comic books, and when I started reading your collected Norse mythology, I thought I didn't know these gods. I thought the gods of Greece and Rome had entered literature so comprehensively in the 19th century that they'd colonised it. And then I was surprised by how many figures had made their way into the stories I knew. How intertwined do you think is Norse mythology with the 21st century?
Well, I think the Norse mythology, it occupies a very different role to Greek and Roman mythology. Greek and Roman myths retold beautifully by Greek and Roman writers and then were such a part of literature and of world literature that they were kept afloat. And in order to understand Victorian poetry, you need to understand the classical allusions that are being made. You need a Lompriere's classical dictionary. The Norse, on the surface, are very different because we don't have that many Norse myths. But then you start looking around and they're everywhere. They're in our days of the week, which is really kind of peculiar. At that point, you go, well, they are. They must be omnipresent. You know, Thursday is Thor's day. Wednesday is Odin's day.
So they're embedded and they're ancient. So why for you, why did you collect the stories together? What did you want to do with this project?
When I was a kid, so I discovered them in Marvel Comics. I then found a lovely book called Myths of the Norsemen by a writer named Roger Lanceling Green, retelling the myths for children and finding that the gods in the stories were not the gods of the comic books. They were much more complicated. They were simpler, odder, but there was much more going on. And that was the point I remember falling in love. And I fell in love again as an adult. Kevin Crossley Holland did a glorious selection of the myths for Penguin. And that was what I used when I was writing a comic called Sandman. I went, you know, I love these myths, I'll use them. And then a few years on from that, I was going to do a book called American Gods, and I knew that some of the gods were going to be the Norse gods. So this time I actually went and read the translations of the original, what are called the Eddas, the poems and the prose by a man named Snorri Sturluson, who were preserving in a post-Christian world what there still was of the ancient Norse stories. By this time, it almost became slightly painful for me that I could make these references to Norse myths, knowing that people wouldn't necessarily know what I was talking about. And I kept wishing that more people would know. And then I had lunch with an editor. And this was about 8 years ago. And I sat down and had a very nice lunch with a lady named Amy Cherry from a publisher called Norton. And she said to me, have you ever thought about retelling Norse mythology for a new audience? And it had really never occurred to me. And I spent several years thinking about it before I gave her an answer back, which was, yes, I want to try it. I spent another couple of years rereading Snorri and thinking about the way that I wanted to tell them, the voice. It was like the myths were there. And normally, as a writer, what I do is make stuff up. That's what I'm famous for. That's what I get loved and celebrated for. I go and make up stories. And here, I was going to be retelling stories. So I had to figure out, well, how was I going to do it? What was the vocabulary choices? What was the voice?
Well, that voice changes as a reader because you begin the book with origin stories and lineages and so on. And that approach is almost biblical. Odin is the father of us all. What did writing about these myths do to how you approached language?
It was absolutely fascinating for me as a kind of a lesson. There was a level on which when you start, you're starting with a creation myth. And if you are doing a creation myth, you need to do it with a certain amount of reverence and awe and mystery. So the first few stories are creation, and then they're world building. You're explaining how the Norse saw the world, what the nine worlds of Norse mythology were, how you could have these worlds linked by an ash tree called Yggdrasil that's bigger than the mind could hold and holds the universe, and of which our world is just one part. So at that point, you are doing what, as a novelist, I would never do. As a novelist, I would just start the story and then you find out the stuff on the way. But after that, once you've created the world, it almost became more fun because now you have your gods living and breathing and walking around in it and getting in each other's way and causing trouble for each other.
I particularly liked the story about the making of the magic objects that are given to the gods. And there are beautiful and intriguing objects, but it's the hammer of Thor that becomes the central object, and it's on the front of your book. What's so special about that object?
Well, the hammer of Thor, it's always been something that seized and grabbed the imagination. We have ancient Viking, they would wear little images of Thor's hammer for luck and for protection. The imagery of the hammer, and the hammer, of course, which is slightly too short in the handle.
Well, you have an explanation of that.
I do. It's one of the amusing things is it gets made for the gods by some dwarfs, and mainly it's Loki trying to get something for nothing out of the dwarfs. And Loki, for his own reasons, is trying very hard to sabotage the making of all of these glorious gifts. So he, in the form of a biting fly, is actually attacking one of the dwarfs who's making the hammer, which is why the handle is a little bit short. But it is this wonderful thing that, it, more than anything, symbolizes, I think, the gods. It's an object, but it's an object of power. Thor is the only person who is strong enough to even carry his hammer. It takes four giants to lift his hammer. And after Thor's death, his two sons have to carry his hammer between them. There's a sort of a feeling here that this is where all of the power of the gods is, and this is what is keeping them safe from the giants, from monsters, from everything. It's all the hammer.
How much does the landscape and the weather birth these stories?
Oh, I think the weather births these stories enormously. You were asking me right at the beginning about the difference between the Greek and Roman gods and the Norse gods. And if you start thinking about the stories that we have of Greek and Roman gods, they're sort of sitting half naked by pools in forests, looking at their own reflection or running daintily after each other through the woodland in hot sexual pursuit, wearing very little. The Norse myths are myths of a cold land. Nobody is going to sit outside half naked staring at their reflection because you'd freeze to death in the winter or be bitten by mosquitoes in the summer. These are stories created to be told aloud through endless dark in the middle of winter, an endless day in the middle of summer. The strange peculiarity of the Nordic climate and the Nordic days.
And yet, Neil Gaiman, in your book American Gods, which is about to be a TV series, the ancient gods are also migrants, and sometimes perhaps they're refugees. They up sticks and they move, they go on a road trip. Is that how they live with you, I wonder, going wherever you go?
Well, I definitely take all of the gods and mythological figures in the back of my mind with me wherever I go. But actually, in the case of American Gods, it started in a very, very specific place for me. I was in Reykjavik in Iceland, and I was just there from a plane stopover. I had 24 hours in Iceland, and it was a dull Sunday, and I was wandering downtown Reykjavik, and everything was closed. And I found a tourist information center, and it was open. And I went in, and they had a diorama and a map of the voyages of Leif Erikson going to the New World. And I thought, that's really interesting. I thought, I wonder if they took their gods with them. And then there was a moment, and I thought, I wonder if they left their gods behind when they came back to Iceland. And suddenly it was like a door opening. I went, now I have a novel. The idea of all of these gods, the Norse gods, the Egyptian gods, everyone who had ever been brought with to America, having to scrabble, having to make their own way in the world as immigrants, as refugees, that somehow seemed very important to me.
Neil Gaiman, thank you so much for speaking to us about Norse mythology.
That was a joy. Thank you.
Neil Gaiman's book, Norse Mythology, is published by Bloomsbury. He spoke to me earlier in the year. I'm Kate Evans, revisiting the best stories of the year on Books Plus for RN Summer. So do join me again next time for novels that play fast and loose with their sense of reality.